Up next, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny joins us. Maybe she can add to this insanity. Her latest work, Fowl Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think. She's also got saying no to vaccines and vaccines, what CDC and science documents don't reveal. That's on a DVD. So her expertise will be very helpful here in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is an osteopathic medical doctor, founder of the OsteoMed 2, an integrative medicine clinic that specializes in a unique form of allergy elimination, breast thermography, and bioidentical hormones. She's currently serving as the executive director of Sarnovi, a medical institute located in Rosarito, Mexico. Dr. Tenpenny is an internationally known expert on the hazards of vaccines. Here she is on Coast to Coast AM. Sherry, how are you?
Good evening, George. Thank you very much. It's nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. This is an incredible story about this bird flu strain that got mixed in with the human strain, could have unleashed a pandemic. Do you think it was a mistake or something else?
Well, you know, I honestly think it was just being totally sloppy. You know, Baxter has been investigating using H5N1 for their vaccine line to try to get into the food trough with all of the different pharmaceutical companies that got their $7 billion to develop this vaccine back in 2006. So they've been looking at it for a long time, and they published an article in the New England Journal in June of 2008 saying that they were very close to developing this H5N1 vaccine, and it was looking really promising. I think that somebody did it. In terms of just plain old sloppy, and somebody needs to be held accountable for it. But I'm not sure that it was actually put in there intentionally. I just don't quite know if I'm willing to go that far.
But sloppy is dangerous. They could
There's
have unleashed
no doubt.
The problem. Okay.
There's no doubt sloppy can be dangerous. Sloppy can kill people.
Lots of people. Sherry.
Lots of people.
I mean, is it true that it could have unleashed a pandemic if it got really out of control?
Well, I suppose that that's potentially a theory. I'm a little wondering about, as much as I've been reading about this story, when they keep talking about this being a live virus, because none of the flu vaccines that are injectable are actual live viruses. They're all attenuated and killed. But there is that possibility of it being of assortment taking place where the genes sort of mix and match and cause a new virus, and a new virus that could be more of a more problematic than either the common everyday flu virus and also these multiple strains of H5S1.
I noticed that Tamiflu apparently is not working against the human strain. What's going on there?
Well, the Tamiflu has been around for a while. You know, that was a really big deal back when all this bird flu stuff was really popular in 2006. And they said that supposedly this year's strain of H3N2, it supposedly is susceptible to Tamiflu. But there's some real problems with Tamiflu. In my book, Fowl, I talked about it a lot, that the problems with Tamiflu is that it in and of itself can cause the viruses to become mutant, and that when it's been exposed, when you've been taking Tamiflu, those strains of flu viruses in your body become resistant to the drug within 4 days of taking it, and that they've found that some viruses can be a million times more resistant to the Tamiflu if they've been exposed to the drug than those viruses that had not been exposed. So that in and of itself, I think, can be as much of a problem over time, because they say about 18% of the flu viruses after they've been exposed to Tamiflu become resistant. Now, that could morph into something that could be a terrible problem.
Absolutely, just like antibiotics and bacteria, same
Absolutely.
Kind of thing. Why do most of these flus start in the Asian nations?
I think a lot of it has to do with the sanitary conditions there, or the lack of sanitation, I guess I could say. You know, as much as we complain about our EPA and our FDA and some of the things that we don't clean up here, they don't have even the equivalent of really an EPA in China. And there's hundreds of billions of tons of chemicals and human sewage and animal dung and bird poop.
And we buy some of that stuff, though, don't we? We get those products here, don't we?
We can get those products here. And the water contamination is there. And the people, like in Southeast Asia, like Cambodia and Thailand and Vietnam, I mean, they live with their chickens. So there's a real issue in terms of swapping human influenza viruses with the bird flu virus.
Educate us a little bit, Sherry. What does it mean when they say like H5N1? What do these numbers mean in these letters?
Well, the letters are actually representative of what the antigens are on the surfaces of the virus. The H5N1 viruses are all in a family of viruses called influenza A, and there are a lot of different species of that. The outer shell of the virus has two types of antigens, and one is called H, and one is called N, and there are 15 different H antigens and 9 different N antigens, and so you have a lot of different combinations of those that come up with the viruses. And that is one thing that is probably a little known fact, is that H5N1 is just one of hundreds of subtypes of H5N1, and it's one of the reasons why they've had trouble developing some sort of a consistent vaccine for it, is because those antigens swap around a lot, and there are hundreds of different types of subtypes.
So you could have H5N2 and, or H6N4?
Well, more like H5N1A and H5N1AB and H5N1X, and so a whole bunch of different types of subtypes. So it's not just one virus. And if you believe what the CDC says about, in order to make a flu shot effective, that you have to have an exact match, well, it's really hard to match something that's changing all the time. And the H5N1, in terms of being around and being able to cause problems, I mean, it's been infecting poultry and causing problems way back since 1959.
Have we ever had an H15?
You know, an H15, depending on who you read, there are some people who use that particular one in some of the medical literature, and sometimes they say it only goes up to 14.
Okay. But it does exist.
It does exist. There's been reports of it in the medical literature, and some people make a bigger deal out of it than others.
Sherry, give me your take on the possibility of a pandemic. I've been saying on this program for years, I don't think it'll be here unless something stupid happens, like what we just had.
I think that if there's a natural virus that can cause it, I think that there will be increased mortality in the extremes of life, like the very young and the very old, like all of the other three pandemics that have been on the planet in the last 100 years or so. Mm-hmm. Persons with chronic disease, people that are very chemically toxic. I talk about that. It's one of the premises of my book, Foul, that I talked about, is that the people that are more contaminated with chemicals, and in particular dioxin, are more likely to die, because they've shown in mice studies that if you take normal garden variety influenza and you expose it to dioxin, that the death rate doubles in the mice. And so there's a combination factor of viruses and toxic environmental chemicals. And we also know that with a lot of the past pandemics, you know, when I really examined those, there were other types of factors like malnutrition. Two of the three were associated with wars. One was World War I, and the other one was when the young men were coming back from Vietnam. And vaccination, I think, contributed to some of their deaths, because their immune systems were suppressed in all three of the wars by giving lots of vaccines before they even went off to serve their duty for their country. And so I think that there's always that potential, because, you know, we don't eat good food and we don't take very good care of ourselves. But unless it's something like a weaponized virus that they make it, that is something very out of nature of what our bodies are used to, I think that we'll see things that have happened in the past, the very old and the very young, and the most of us will weather right on through.
Sherry, why isn't this story, though, making its way into the mainstream media? This story of this contamination, this mistake that occurred.
Well, you know, George, it's because all of those things about the pharmaceutical industry never really make it into the mainstream media.
This is a huge story.
You know, like a couple weeks ago, you know, when the vaccine court ruled that those three cases of those young children that they kept saying that, you know, the MMR does not cause autism, it went over 1,300 news outlets. Every news internet outlet, everybody across the country was talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And less than 2 weeks later, a different court ruled that the MMR did cause autism in another young boy. Not a peep.
Not a peep.
Didn't hear a word about it from anybody, yep. Hardly.
Hardly, exactly.
You know? And so so whenever there is something that rules in the favor of the drug companies or the vaccine companies or shows that, oh, gosh, they're safe, effective, they protect you, and they're harmless, oh, that's everywhere on the news. But anything that might show up like a big mistake like this or that something was causing a problem with vaccines, nobody says anything about
Shouldn't
it.
Shouldn't the FDA and the CDC come down on Baxter for this problem?
Well, you would think.
Yeah.
You definitely would think. I mean, it should be something like a complete global public embarrassment to them, and that they should not be allowed to handle that virus anymore, the H5N1 or anything else that could cause potential problems, until they get their act cleaned up. But you know what, George? This isn't the first time something like this has happened.
It's not, and it makes you wonder, you know, when people years ago said that the AIDS virus was created in the test tube and then released into some of these third world nations, and now it festered all over the world. You know, originally when I thought that, sure, I said, this is preposterous. But you know what? Nowadays, I'm not so sure it is.
Well, I don't think it's preposterous at all. I mean, when you look at what the actual ingredients are in the vaccines, I mean, that the polio vaccine is made from chicken, and now these new vaccines. In fact, Baxter's flu vaccines aren't approved in this country, and they are being made with vero cells, which is African kidney monkey cells, and we've got dog cells, and we've got caterpillar eggs, and we've got aborted fetuses, and human retinal tissue, and we've got all those different DNAs that are in there. I mean, and there's actually a division of the FDA that actually meets several times a year to discuss the potential problem of contaminant viruses that are in the vaccines that could be causing other types of long-term genetic problems. So they know that there's problems with that. They know that there's chemical problems. They know that there's viral contaminants. There's reports that saying as many as 6% of all vaccines have mycoplasma in them. And so they know that these things are there, but yet this whole sort of image that what's coming through the vaccine is just sterile water. In fact, I recently wrote an article called "The MMR is Not Holy Water," because you actually would think that when things are being injected, that's what it was. You would think that somebody needs to bless it as opposed to saying that it's something that could really cause harm.
What happens one day, Sherry, when they try to force us to take specific vaccines and people say, nope, not going to do it to me?
Well, I think that's going to be a real problem. You know, back when you and I first started talking about this, George, back in 2000,
ago.
Actually,
yeah.
It was in 2001 when we started talking about this. They started laying the groundwork for the potential problems with mandatory vaccination. And I used to think that it was just something that was laying around in the backdrop, but like a lot of government things, they lay in a drawer until the appropriate time, and then first thing you know, they produce a 900-page document out of thin air, which tells me that it's been in process for a long time. And I get really concerned about that. And I, you know, you even see like simple things like in New Jersey, when now they're requiring flu shots for kids to enter school. And there's being more and more requirements of even the known vaccines that I get very concerned about the possibility of smallpox or anthrax or any of these other vaccines coming door to door for us.
What were you doing at the Sarnovi Medical Institute in Mexico?
At Sarnovi's?
Yeah, so is that how you pronounce it?
At Sarnovi's, yes, it is. Yes, I'm actually acting as the executive director down there. I've been down there since September. It's just a wonderful place. It's a hospital that's very unique and of itself. It's a 47-bed hospital that has the look and feel of a 5-star resort. And people come there from all over the world because it's a truly integrated medicine hospital. So it's not your conventional hospital. We use all sorts of integrative and alternative types of techniques to get people well.
Well, you know what? I'm a booster of alternative medicine, that's for sure. We're going to take some calls with you when we come back. But I've got a quick message in from Dr. Robin Falkov, and she wants to know if you know anything about thieves of oil, which was an essential oil that thieves used in the Middle Ages to rob dead bodies and they protected that from the plague. You ever hear of that stuff?
I have heard of that stuff, and actually I use that stuff.
And it's called Thieves of Oil?
It's one of the essential oils, and it's the name of it is Thieves, and it came after that from the scenario that she just described. And I usually take a couple of sprays and put it like on across like my chest area when I go to get on an airplane to just sort of be breathing in this nice essential oil type of
there's
smell.
There's nothing worse than airplane air, I'll tell you.
Yeah, but it's not as bad as people think, or everybody would be coming off of the jetway and just be keeling over into the airport.
Yeah, but they do get sick a couple days later. I have found more people lately who have been on a plane, and they're fine when they get on, but a couple days later, they get the sniffles, they get a sore throat, they come down with a cough. They have a cough now that they can't get rid of. There's something going on, Sherry.
Well, that could be, but you know, George, I really thoroughly maintain that health is not a vaccine deficiency, that health is an inside-out phenomenon, and that if you really do all of the basic stuff to keep yourself healthy, like vitamin C and vitamin A before you get on an airplane, because those are your two very best antivirals. And if you're going to be on a plane more than 2 hours, you should be taking another 500 or 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C while you're en route. Getting plenty of sleep, you know, drinking water, getting some exercise, going outside and getting your skin exposed to sunlight for vitamin D. All of those things are an inside-out phenomenon because there are plenty of people on airplanes who don't get sick. And the real science is looking at those people and not trying to figure out why the other people do get sick.
How'd you feel about living in Mexico for a while? You know, you got the drug cartels all over the place.
Well, I just think, you know, it's like a lot of things in the news, George. You know, Rosarito is actually a completely different city than what TJ is, what Tijuana is. In fact, do you know off the top of your head what the population of Tijuana is?
1.4 million.
2.5 million.
And the last time I looked, it said 1.4 million.
It's between 2 and 2.5 million, and I actually had a meeting with the mayor the other day, and we were talking about that.
You've had a lot of people move there then since the last thing.
Yeah, see, it's not as bad as what people say. And, you know, it's interesting that you should say that because I've asked many of my friends, how big do you think that Tijuana is? Because in the news, they always talk about border towns. And the largest number that I heard from a lot of very well-traveled and educated people was 230,000. So I think people have this perception that it's this shanty town, and it's like they shoot out at the OK Corral, which it's really not. I mean, there were 29 million Americans that crossed that border last year, and people,
wow.
29 million. And what happened to all of them was nothing. The minor things that happened for the vast majority of people were things like minor robberies, fender benders, and bar brawls. So it's really very distorted in the news.
Well, but not to be confused with a true drug war that's going on down there.
Oh, absolutely, and it's Mexican against Mexican, and it is ugly. And could you be shot? Sure.
If you're in the wrong place.
At the wrong place at the wrong time, just like if you were in New York or Chicago or South L.A. And for people who sort of kind of think about what's happening in Tijuana or Juarez, which are more than 1,500 miles apart, and they sort of categorize the entire country as this whole thing that's happening, it's kind of like saying you've been to South L.A. and saying, oh, I'm never going to America because I know what that place is like.
Right. Well, that's true, too. So I'm going to take phone calls with you when we come back in just a moment. But what do people do who are, you know, concerned about their children? You know, you got these vaccines out there. They're being bombarded. You got to get vaccinated. You got to get vaccinated. What should a parent do?
Well, first of all, they need to know what their rights are, and they need to know that all 50 states have exemptions, and there's 19 states that actually have what's called a philosophical exemption, which means that if you don't want your child to be vaccinated, you just fill out a form, turn it into the school, and that's the end of it.
Well, that's interesting, because in the old days, it was just religious, right?
Yes, and all states except West Virginia and Mississippi have religious exemptions, and some of them are harder to get qualified for than others. Some states are more difficult than others. In fact, New York is really tough. But still, parents do have a right to refuse. You just have to know how to work.
See, what's scary for a parent, though, Sherry, they don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to think, what if I'm wrong? What if Sherry Tenpenny is wrong? What if things that I've heard are wrong? What if vaccines are really good for you? I don't want to be the one to harm my child. So it's a difficult decision, isn't it?
It's certainly a difficult decision, George, and I never make light of it. In fact, part of what my whole responsibility to this is to get the information out there and let people think and come up with the answers for themselves. And wouldn't they rather feel, you know, nobody wants their child to get sick. We just talked about keeping your keeping yourself healthy from an inside-out phenomenon, and the same applies to children. And so, if you know, the main thing the parents can do is to get your kids to bed on time.
Well, you know, they put that junk in the shots in the 50s, and I'm convinced it's in me, Sherry.
You know, it's probably in most everybody, but not to the same amount, George. I mean, as recently as 1985, kids got 33 vaccine antigens by the time they started kindergarten.
33? What did I get in 1950? What
do you think? Probably the same if you got everything, but today it's 113.
Oh, my gosh. Stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines, vaccinations, and this bird flu mix-up that we've been talking about with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we'll take as many of your calls this half hour with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, so we'll get right to it when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. We will take your phone calls as well. Sherry, what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm spending an awful lot of time in the vaccine things, working on the stuff that has to do with Gardasil. I've been given a lot of talks about that and a lot of presentations, and spending my time going back and forth, between Rosarito and Ohio. I spend 3 weeks a month in Rosarito and 1 week a month in Ohio, and I'm traveling around being involved with the Medical Tourism Association, and I'm just really busy.
You're everywhere.
I am everywhere.
All right, to the calls we go. Tunnel Hill, Georgia. First-time caller, Sarah, you're on with us. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, George. Hello, Ms. Tenpenny.
Okay, go ahead.
Good evening.
Oh, I'm so glad to talk to you. My question was, well, I took the first Gardasil vaccination, and I know there are three in a row, and I took the one, and I was real scared and leery about it, and the lady at the doctor's office, you know, she's like, I'm sure it's safe. So I took it, but I was afraid to take the other two, and I'm wondering what the repercussions of taking the first shot might have been.
Well, how long ago was it that you had the shot?
Probably about 6 months ago.
And have you had any negative ramifications since then?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not that you're aware of? Then more than likely your body has cleared out the vast majority of that. Mm-hmm. You know, the biggest problem with the Gardasil vaccine is the large amount of aluminum that's in there. There's also something called polysorbate 80, which can cause hives and anaphylactic reactions, and I think that's one of the things that are making a lot of the girls pass out and faint is because of the reaction to that, because their body's been primed to that chemical because it's also in a DPT vaccine that they may have gotten when they were younger. It also has sodium borate in it, which has had some concerns about reproductive problems in rats for both men and for women. And you know that that Merck has large studies going on right now to try to double their market share and to start giving this vaccine to little boys. So you have legitimate concerns about not wanting to take the other two. And a question that comes up a lot with parents, not only with this vaccine but with other ones, are if I've given my children one or some of the vaccines, is it okay to stop and not give any more? Will there be any repercussions from that? And the answer is absolutely not. It's perfectly okay to become educated and decide that you want to do other things to keep yourself healthy.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And I've actually found in a lot of my research, and if they go to my website, which is drtenpenny.com,
DR for doctor, by the way.
Doctor or doctor. D-O-T-T-O-R.
Oh, you got it both ways now? Good, good.
And I'll tell you what, in honor of being on Coast to Coast tonight, we've been building a new website, and I had my my web guy, whose name is Nick, who's done this marvelous job on creating this new website for me. We hustled today to launch it just tonight, especially for Coast to Coast. And if people, and we're actually having a special on Coast to Coast, if you put in to order one of the books, particularly the Saying No to Vaccines book, if you put in C2C for Coast to Coast, there's a special and you get it's usually a $55 book, you'll get it for $29.95.
Sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
As a Coast to Coast listener. So,
very good. About 99% of my emails I'm getting with you and Alex, extremely positive. I mean, extremely positive. But I got one from someone who said, why are you trying to scare people?
Oh, I don't think we're trying to scare people at all.
We didn't create this mixture of the virus.
I think that actually what we're trying to do is to educate people and to say, open your eyes and look around. Open your eyes. In fact, George, ever since I started doing all of this, I've always considered myself sort of like Joanna Appleseed, that it's my job to throw the seeds out there, but it's not my responsibility to make them sprout.
Once they grow, they grow.
And if they grow about 25%, if you go by the biblical parable of the sower, about 25% lands on good soil and grows up and sprouts and bears more seed. And so in some of it's rocky soil, and some of the birds take it away, and some of the weeds choke it out. And so it's not my responsibility to make the seed grow. But I think you do a fabulous job. I know Alex does a fabulous job. I spend a lot of time telling people there is so much more to this vaccine issue than what you're ever going to hear from your pediatrician or your family doctor.
Absolutely. Ryan in Denver, Colorado, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, George.
Hi.
And hi, Dr. Tempany.
Good evening. Good morning.
Just say, Sherry, wherever you may be.
Wherever you may be.
Yes. I was wondering if you could help shed some light on a little hypothesis I've been tinkering with. I've been sort of studying the idea that everything emits a biofrequency, an electromagnetic signal. And I'm a musician, and I know if you take any wave or any frequency and then take the inverse of that wave and overlay it, the two frequencies will cancel each other out. And I was wondering if that might have any medical implications.
Well, sure it does. I mean, you know, ultrasound waves have some issues like that. The Rife machine used to work like that, where they would use inverse sine waves to vibrate and actually shatter viruses.
Shutting people down with that machine now, aren't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can mostly get that treatment outside the country. I mean, there's so many really positive things that we had available here in the U.S., like UV light radiation and Rife machines and the uses of ozone. I mean, there's thousands of articles published on the positive uses of ozone around the world, and we're not allowed to use it in the U.S., and it's my opinion it's because it's too successful. So I think that, yes, I do believe that there are some resonant energy, and there's a lot of biofrequency machines like Vega Technologies and different things like that that I think you're really, really onto something there.
Okay, great. Are there any vaccines out there, Sherry, that you like?
No.
Oh, putting it bluntly.
No.
It's almost like asking, have you been on a date with anybody you like, Sherry? No. Next up, let's go to Kansas City, Missouri. Milt. Hi, Milt. Take it away.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
Back in 1975, I was on a flight from Dallas-Fort Worth to Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And there was a gentleman sitting next to me who said he was from the CDC. I was reading an article from Penthouse Magazine that I had received almost a month early because I was on an early mailing list because I'd been overseas. And he said, hey, that's me. And he showed me his CDC credentials. The article stated that the AIDS virus came from testing of, let me get my words right.
Okay.
It was tested in these clinics for a flu shot. And it was tested in five cities, and most of the testing was done at clinics where most of the people were homosexual. And they said that's how it got into the homosexual community, according to this. In this article, it said that it was so new that it still didn't have a name, but it had CDC so worried that they had individuals working on it. This particular gentleman said that he was on the carpet going to Washington, D.C. because he had given the interview. And a week later, I saw in the paper that he committed suicide.
Jeez.
Oh.
Have you heard of this at all, Sherry?
I have not. I have not.
Well, you know how the testing program goes, where we have a new drug that is taken out to testing centers where it's given to people under trials. And it said that this vaccine was made from the green monkey liver.
Now, you've heard
and
that
then
part.
The vaccine was then introduced, even though it wasn't allowed in the United States because they had traced it back, it was still introduced into Africa.
Sherry, why do they use body parts of animals in vaccines?
Like well, that this. Started really with the polio vaccine, George. It started with that they were trying to figure out how to make the virus multiply, the polio virus multiply and replicate at a large enough level that they could harvest it and turn it into a vaccine. And they found that it seemed to grow the best and be able to harvest it if they used African green monkey cells. And so that's where the Vero cells sort of have come from. And, you know, the whole thing with AIDS, I'm not an AIDS researcher, and I don't spend a lot of time in that literature, but I do know that some people have talked about it being hepatitis B-related, and some people have talked about it being polio-related. And probably Alex Jones probably could tell you more about that, or Lenny Horowitz, that those are sort of areas that they go into.
Lenny hates vaccines.
Yeah,
you know.
I know. I know. I've known Len for a long time.
I mean, with a passion.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I can't answer that question directly. It's not any direct knowledge that I have, but it doesn't actually surprise me.
And, you know, when you mix these animal cells then in a vaccine and then they inject them in humans, are we getting those animal cells in our body? Of course, right?
Yeah, we do. In fact, there's some standards that the FDA makes for the vaccines that they say that only so many animal cells are allowed into the vaccines. They keep it under like 2 million cells or something like that. And there's DNA particles that are come from these animal cells and also DNA particles from contaminant viruses and bacteria. They know it. They know that it's there. They meet on a regular basis talking about these contaminants.
Do these pharmacists, these people who develop these biochemists, do they take vaccines?
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I've never really
seen that. They probably said, I'm not going to put that stuff in me.
I've never really seen that, but I do know that there have been studies that have shown that less than 55% of doctors and nurses vaccinate their kids, or that less than 55% take flu shots. So I've never seen any studies about actual bench researchers and whether or not they do vaccines. But that's a really good question.
Okay, next up, let's go to, and thanks, Milt, for bringing that forward, Albany, New York, Glenda, east of the Rockies. Hey, Glenn.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question about the tetanus vaccine. Is this a safe vaccine?
Well, there's no such thing as a safe vaccine. I mean, there just isn't. And you can prove that just very simply by pulling out the package inserts. So you can see all of the potential side effects and all of the problems. And the tetanus vaccine, you know, let me take a step back from that. I mean, the tetanus vaccine, you know, why do you get tetanus? It's because you have a dirty wound that has not been cleaned out. And the most important thing that you can do in terms of cleaning out it, when you get a wound is good wound hygiene. Let it bleed for a few minutes, bring in the healing cells, wash it out with soap and water, wash it out with hydrogen peroxide, because the bug that causes tetanus, Clostridium tetani, cannot grow in the presence of oxygen. It's an anaerobic bug. So if you can clean that out really well, the chances of you getting tetanus from any type of a cut goes down substantially. And there are many cases in the medical literature where people had what was called a protective antibody level, that they had very high levels of tetanus antibodies, and I talk about that a lot in the book, that they got tetanus anyways. So, you know, that's the moral of the story of all of the vaccines, is that you can get the vaccine, it gives you a very false sense of security, and you can get the infection anyways. But in the meantime, you've taken on all the risk of all the contaminants that are in the vaccines.
Okay, thanks, Glenda. Glenda? She's gone. Tyson, let's go to Boise, Idaho, west of the Rockies. Hi there.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I've been listening for about 6 months, and this is the first time I've called in. I do have a couple questions. The first is my wife just got into nursing school, and just to get into the program, she had to take just a plethora of vaccines, and she's about 31 years old.
Did you have any reaction after that?
Maybe like some flu-like symptoms and stuff like that. Didn't feel well for a couple of days, but the main concern is just that it seems as though in that profession, it's kind of like an ongoing requirement to even participate in that profession to be able to keep current with all your vaccinations. And I was just wondering if there's like with the children, how you can have the form that says, you know, we don't want to do it. Is there anything in the medical profession that where you can kind of protest not being vaccinated, being in hospitals and stuff like that?
That's a phenomenally important question. Thank you for asking that. Because the healthcare professionals are getting hammered, and particularly nurses. And there have been two lawsuits already from major hospital associations, of nursing associations, because they were threatened with their jobs if they didn't take a flu shot. And both of those court cases were held up in favor of the nurses having the right to refuse. And even though the Nursing Association came out with a statement saying, we believe in vaccines, we believe in flu shots, we also believe that people should have the right to choose. When it comes to the hepatitis B vaccine, there is an OSHA exemption, and that's available on my website, where you can download that, or you can go out to OSHA.gov and you can find that. And what that does is it allows you legally to refuse the hepatitis B vaccine. Now, some of it varies from state to state and district to district, but that gives you some place to go by, and it's the OSHA, OSHA. The other thing that people need to know that they can do is that if they've been vaccinated previously, that maybe they had all their childhood vaccines, or they've had vaccines for various things along the way, that they can get a blood test called a titer test, spelled T-I-T-E-R, a titer test, that is actually looking to see if you have what the medical establishment would call protective antibodies. And if you have an adequate level of those antibodies, then you can get what's called a proof of immunity exemption, and you won't have to get revaccinated. And interestingly enough, George, the U.S. military now accepts titer tests as proof of immunity, so those young men don't have to get all vaccinated all over
That's
again.
That's not bad. The cross between a human and an animal, isn't it called a chimera? I think it is, something like that. That's what they're turning us into.
Well, you would have to think so at some point. You know, what is that? What is all that DNA that's doing?
It's one thing having a pig's valve in your heart to keep you alive, but
well,
it's another thing.
And that DNA is maybe or maybe not being mixed into you. I mean, I don't really know about pig valves, but when this is being injected into our children, and what I said right before the break, that kids now, if they get all recommended vaccines by the time they start kindergarten, they will get 113 vaccine antigens and milligram amounts of chemicals injected into their body. Now the next round of vaccines is going towards the adolescents with the Gardasil, the Menactra, which is the college meningitis vaccine. There's 21 vaccines in the pipeline aimed at adolescents.
How much money are we talking about?
Billions.
Yeah.
Billions. And so now if they get all the ones that are recommended by junior high and get all the boosters, the MMR booster, the pertussis booster, they will now get 150 vaccine antigens by the time they're in junior high. It doesn't take a doctor to recognize that can cause problems.
Grab a quick question from Eric in California, first-time caller. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
Hey, this is the weirdest thing, but in 1986, I was in Navy boot camp in San Diego, California, and I got an influenza shot, which was my first shot I ever got, never got one since then. But since then, I've never gotten the flu. 23 years, never gotten the flu. The only thing that I ever get is occasionally I'll get a temperature spike. Feels just like the flu, lasts maybe a few minutes. And I was just wondering if there's anything with that.
Probably not, because they've actually shown in the medical literature, the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a research think tank out of Rome, has evaluated all the published studies on the flu shot, published in for all age groups, pediatric, middle age, and elderly, in all languages. And at the conclusion of that, and they've looked at it twice, and at the conclusion of it, they said that getting a flu shot was no more effective in protecting you from getting the flu than placebo. The other thing is in the CDC's literature, it actually says that about 25% of people who get the flu shot can still get the flu. They get something that's called influenza-like illnesses,
yes,
which is
that's
a different
right.
type of bug, and the flu shot doesn't do anything for that anyway.
73-year-old friend of mine in St. Louis, she went out, got the flu shot, came back a couple days later, sicker than a dog.
And that happens a lot. I mean, it really does happen a lot because I don't know how they, I mean, all of those viruses can't all be totally killed because they're attenuated.
Sherry, thank you so much for the information. When we come back, Seth Shostak joins us. Confessions of an Alien Hunter.